This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 21st, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 427. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and it's winter solstice. Let the light shine. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, the MMA panel is back for the special Christmas year-end roundtable. Who deserves a candy cane? Who deserves a lump of coal? I'm joined by Mario Canseco and Andy Yan. Here we are at the Main on Main, and it's Christmas time, 2025, hey. On the Breaker.News podcast, and we're reconvening the MMA roundtable. The table this time is not round, it is rectangular, so for those of you who are sticklers for detail, we're just giving you that disclaimer first. But over here is Andy Yan, the Duke of Data, the A in the MMA, and over here is Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co. Of course, Andy is the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. Mario is the president of Research Co. here in Vancouver. And I'm Bob Mackin, the editor and publisher of the Breaker.News, host of the Breaker.News podcast. And here we are on the Christmas edition of the podcast. We're all dressed in our finest Christmas attire to talk about what happened this year around Vancouver, around British Columbia and Canada. To rate and debate and give people candy canes if they were nice and lumps of coal if they didn't have such a great year. Now, we're gonna start locally because Maine on Maine, we're very close to Vancouver City Hall, and it was kind of a difficult year for the ABC majority on City Council. They didn't get what they wanted. Senate didn't bring Ken Sim, the end of the elected park board. Ken Sim must be very, very sad, and he got a lump of coal basically from the NDP. He asked for it so dearly and so politely, and David Eby didn't deliver. Did get a tax freeze. They pushed through a tax freeze at City Hall, and that meant some people got laid off because they had to cut back. And I guess Ken Sim and the ABC majority, they're very happy like kids on Christmas morning because they slapped a $10 tax on freedom of information requests. This party that's governing City Hall, coming to an election in 2026 and hosting the FIFA World Cup, the biggest, most expensive event in Vancouver since the 2010 Winter Olympics, and making it harder for the public to know how they're spending the money, even though they say that zero means zero. We'll start with you, Mario Canseco. The performance of Mayor Ken Sim and the ABC majority at Vancouver City Hall in 2025, do they deserve a candy cane or a lump of coal?
I'd say it's a mixed bag for a couple of reasons. I think there will be property owners who are going to be very happy with the fact that their taxes aren't going to be higher. There's a sense of dissatisfaction on some of the services provided by the city, but not at the level that we saw before. It's not going to be as bad as it was for Sam Sullivan, for instance, when we had the garbage strike. And I think they benefit from dealing with a disjointed opposition. We're not there at the end of the year yet, and you already have candidates who have announced that they're running. You have a primary sort of happening with one BC. With one city. Sorry, that was bad. And you know, there's a chance that if the splits work in a specific way, Ken Sim could still be mayor of the city with the support of 35-37% of voters, maybe less than that, depending on how the situation unfolds. Partly because there's been a difficulty in getting the voter turnout out as high as it should be. You know, we haven't had more than half of voters participating in a municipal election in Vancouver since 2002. and you know, there's more interest, there's more at play, there's more parties, there's more slates, there's more ads, and yet the voter participation continues to drop. So whoever wants to crack that code is going to have to get voters out. We have the example of what happened in New York with Mamdani, mm-hmm. Where the voter turnout goes up by 17 points, and he brings new voters into the fold. So it's not just about talking to people who voted for Ken Sim and asking them if they're upset, because if they are property owners, they probably won't be. Mm-hmm. It's more about bringing new voters into the fold.
Yep. Now, Andy, Ann, candy cane or lump of coal for Ken Sim and his ABC majority on city council? We did see a bit of a hiccup early in the year back in April, the by-election, which was so poorly organized, and it blew up in their face, basically. The two left-wing candidates made it on with a sizable vote tally on that day, and the two ABC candidates had the worst tally of all party-affiliated candidates in the by-election.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think lump of coal or candy cane, mound of uranium. That I think that this is a kind of interesting moment for ABC, just given I think where it sits. Because while zero means zero for property owners, it doesn't mean that for renters. That there's a 2.5% increase that renters can have in the city of Vancouver. And I point it out because the city of Vancouver is a majority renter city. That we've been actually a majority renter city since 1971. So I think that this is a kind of interesting moment to see whether renters are organized, whether renters, I think this is of course the other challenge, is the kind of diversity of renters and their kind of states of their kind of where they are in their lives sometimes have a challenge towards showing up to vote. But if they do show up to vote, that I think brings a new dynamic in perhaps a forthcoming election. But that also being said is also the changes that this is not the same ABC that we had at the beginning of this administration, that it's really one that through which has seen some changes. Actually, the former chief of staff is running, one of the candidates running against Ken Sim in this, Karim Alam. But then the flip side of that is also the organization, that you have to think about that this wasn't, say, a traditional kind of west side of Vancouver deciding who is in city council, but then actually the southeast corner of the city pulling in the size numbers of votes for certainly Ken Sim, but also his ABC party. So I think that this is really going to be the interesting thing to watch, is whether he'll be able to kind of get that base back and activate that base again, but having a very different team. That of course it's also bringing in, acknowledging that this team right now is very different from the team he had at the beginning of his of his mayoralty. That with Ken Sim, I think the interesting question is the fact that he has, I think, shifted right in a lot of policies through which he first kind of came in as the new guy, as kind of, hey, we're going to try this new way of governing civically. But yet, I think the kind of swings that ABC has done, I think when it comes to not only, say, zero means zero, but yet the kind of rezonings that have occurred and the kind of policies that they've adapted, which also include a no net new supportive housing kind of mandate, I think really kind of frames up really which kinds of policies they're going to be talking about. But then it's also, I think the kind of wild card is really the state of development and real estate development, their kind of passing of really what surmounts to be really a relief act for developers. And yet the relief is perhaps at a level through which is much bigger in terms of the kind of forces that are changing development in the city of Vancouver, for which has for a long time depended upon new real estate development for a lot of amenities and to kind of maintain a certain stability in terms of taxes. So not to kind of continue, obsess about the city, although I'd love to, that it's really, I think, really a kind of changing time for civic politics, certainly in the city of Vancouver. But then, of course, I think across the region, we're also seeing the kind of challenges of what happens when perhaps the real estate market, the real estate market is changing, and we're not seeing the kind of sales and the kind of development volumes that we had in previous years and decades. So it's going to be something to watch for the next year.
Now, my nominee for the biggest news story in the Lower Mainland for 2025, perhaps in BC, it was also the biggest tragedy in Vancouver history, April 26th, mm-hmm. the Lapu Lapu Day mm-hmm. Festival, a massacre, a vehicle ramming attack, 11 people killed, dozens and dozens of people injured. The first responders deserve the ultimate candy cane, golden candy cane, each one of them, if we could give them each a candy cane. A lump of coal in many ways should go to City Hall and the police for not securing that street where the food trucks were set up on. And I don't think there's been enough accountability. Mm-hmm. there will be accountability. There is the one person that was charged with driving the vehicle, but there should have been rigid barriers on either side. City Hall was actually warned. I've got a report, an affidavit from the head of security for City Hall side for the World Cup, who warned that vehicle ramming attacks are becoming a major concern worldwide. Right. There was one in New Orleans on New Year's Day, and there was a major lapse, and we haven't seen accountability. We saw accountability in some ways after the Stanley Cup riot in 2011, and Mike Klassen, the city councilor today with ABC, was back then with the City Caucus blog and was pushing for accountability. He was also an NPA candidate. And here we haven't seen that same level of accountability. There are people who were victims and families of victims who have hired lawyers, and there's a lawsuit that's going to work its way through the courts, just as on the criminal side with the alleged perpetrator of this. But do you agree that there has not been enough accountability when it comes to what happened there on that night, terrible night? I got a call from one of my City Hall sources that something had happened. Go and see what happened, and it was just a shocking night, you know, for those of us who were reporters who showed up, but the first responders, you know, they train for this to happen, they hope it never happens, but the worst possible night of some of their careers, as well as the people who went there for a good time with the Filipino community.
I think absolutely, and I think it's also important to kind of note really how these street festivals are now a key part of the civic life of Vancouverites and around the region. And I think this is really one of the kind of interesting points you've made, Bob, is where's the investigation? Where's the deeper kind of analysis in terms of what needs to be done to prevent these types of this type of situation happening? And I think that this is really going into the challenges in terms of really looking at the kind of risk in terms of having these events, although they now are such a key point in bringing us together as a community.
I agree. I think it'll be important to see how much the city is prepared for the World Cup. I mean, you're going to have a situation where there's going to be a lot of people in specific places. You're going to have tighter controls over security. But you never know what could happen in the stands. You never know what can happen next to the venues. And this is going to be a significant challenge. It's kind of like being a pilot, right? Nobody's going to report the fact that you landed the plane. But if something doesn't go well, it could eventually become a big issue for the city, because that is the thing that people will focus on. You know, we had the World Cup in this many cities, and this is the only one where we had a security concern.
Now, looking at the provincial scene here in 2025, this has been a year that has been the year of Trump in many ways. Donald Trump has been the most consequential politician here in Canada, as well as here in British Columbia. In British Columbia, it started off with Premier David Eby grabbing American liquor, taking American liquor off the shelves. You know, whether it's bourbon, whether it's California wine, whether it's American beer, it's off the shelves, giving opportunity for British Columbians who are in that business who make product here. So in some ways, the candy cane to David Eby for helping local, vintners, brewers, and distillers to get their products out there. Yet this has been really his only strategy coming out of the election in 2024, coming into 2025, is jumping on the Trump train in many ways to divert attention from the NDP and all of its shortcomings when it comes to the big issues that you identified in the polls coming up to the 2024 election when it comes to healthcare, housing affordability, and of course the major situation with the continuing crisis of addictions and overdoses. Mario, is David Eby running out of tricks, running out of tools in his toolbox? Of course, politicians love to talk about their toolboxes and their tools when it comes to the Donald Trump issue that he really tried to exploit.
Well, Trump is such a complicated issue because it changes every day. Like, you could be asking Canadians on a Tuesday, and Wednesday about Donald Trump. And they'll say, oh, we don't care about it anymore. We're fine. We're going to focus on other things. And then he'll say something dumb on Friday, and then we're back at square one. So that is part of the complexity of the challenges of dealing with something like this. They were able to capitalize on the sentiment that most Canadians had when Donald Trump said that he wanted to make Canada the 51st state. It's all about timing, the same timing that helps Mark Carney become prime minister fairly easily. When 4 months earlier, it looked like Pierre Poilievre was going to run away with a significant majority government. I think this is the year, or next year, 2026, where the NDP needs to desperately get a win. I think they benefited from the turmoil of the BC Conservatives, which ended with John Rostad quitting 24 hours after a caucus revolt. I don't think 1BC is a particularly important issue. I think if you can fit your representatives, your staff, and your board members in the same elevator, you shouldn't be considered a political party. And you know, history has proven that this was a six-month experiment that yielded nothing. There's no future for a party that behaves that way. I think we've seen it federally with the People's Party. But you know, there's a conservative leadership race. We don't know yet the guidelines that are going to be there for it. Is it going to be more about fundraising? Are they going to weigh the results by writing? We don't know anything about it. And that could lead to somebody who's significantly more charismatic than John Rostad. Note that that's difficult to achieve, to become the leader of the Conservatives and to try to connect with Metro Vancouver voters.
Do you think that the NDP should get a candy cane or a lump of coal for doing the BC ferries deal with China? Now, they're going to get four new ferries, so that means people will have less wait times and can get back and forth across the water to Vancouver Island or the Sunshine Coast and back. But, of course, they're going to be on ferries made in China by state-owned shipyards. We don't know the full price tag yet. So do you think convenience is good, or do you think it should have been built here in Canada? Do you think that these ships are worth a candy cane or a lump of coal?
Perhaps neither. Is perhaps the issue of a ghost story. Is that what you get? And it isn't one of a happy holiday tale, but a ghost story that really the story of fast ferries kind of haunt this entire situation. Really attempts of trying to establish a shipbuilding industry back in British Columbia is also haunting this entire story, and yet the unfortunate failures that have occurred. And I think that in an ideal situation, of course, we'd have this new industry that would happen in British Columbia, but yet the kind of incredible frictions, the kind of investments that would need to occur to kind of introduce this industry back into this region, on top of the kind of global changes, I think makes it actually very difficult. But yet at the same time, the kind of current kind of state of economic development in the province, I think, goes into the need and demand that all this money that the public purse is spending go back to investing into British Columbia as opposed to being extracted out into the rest of the world. But yet, I think it also touches upon the kind of tremendous demands on BC ferries, and yet also how it needs to balance both the delivery of the services with a level of affordability, and then also time. So I think in one way, it ideally would, of course, be best built in British Columbia, but yet all these other demands, I think, have shaped the kind of decision to build in China, but yet the image of how this looks like, I think, is really a big challenge. But then I should note that I think, from my understanding, a lot of the, certainly the kind of, the basic framework of the boats will be built in China, but yet the filling out, the equipping of the build of the boat would actually occur elsewhere.
Now, Mario Canseco, this was a bit of a turning point for the NDP in June. David Eby was on a trade mission in Asia when it was announced, and there was no one from the NDP to talk to on the first day. They tried to say, oh, this is a BC Ferries decision, but of course we found out later that there was a $1 billion loan from the federal government that helped enable this, and so it became a federal story. This year of elbows up, well, David Eby and the NDP put their elbows down and decided to do this deal with China for these ferries. I'm trying, through freedom of information, to get to the bottom of it, and have complained to the Information Privacy Commissioner's office to get the contract, to get the key documents that tell the story of the procurement about who the other bidders were, and the real reasons why they decided to go this way, and why they didn't go with C-SPAN. You know, C-SPAN hired lobbyists who were former NDP insiders, executive directors of the party, former president of the party. You know, they have a track record here. They're doing a lot of work with the federal government, with the Coast Guard, the military. They wanted the job. They could have made it happen. Of course, it would have cost a little more, but more money would have been pumped into the economy here in British Columbia. But here the big controversy is the money is going to be going into the pockets of the Chinese Communist Party, into a shipyard that might be working on People's Liberation Army Navy projects that could be directed to invade Taiwan, and we don't want that to happen. So here we've got the situation where the NDP gets involved in geopolitics and doesn't help employ British Columbians. Mm-hmm. Now, that got the building trades, the blue collar workers, the steel workers and others very angry. The ferry workers, of course, they wanted it built here. There was also the BC General Employees Union that went on strike. There's other unions that aren't very happy. Healthcare workers, nurses, about safety in hospitals. And then on the other side of things, the NDP has alienated a lot of people in the environmental movement, and some of them have left the NDP entirely and gone to the Greens because of David Eby embracing the liquefied natural gas export industry, which actually had a milestone this year, the first shipment from British Columbia of BC LNG over to Asia. So do you think that this is going to have a long-term effect on the NDP with various people who are taking away the candy canes that you used to give the NDP and giving them a lump of coal and going elsewhere with their votes?
I think this will really hinge on how the electorate that is age 55 and over behaves. That is going to be the big decision when it comes to what is happening with the NDP. Right now, it's a group of people that, if we go back to previous elections, used to be very heavily BC Liberal. You know, for Christy Clark, everything changed for this group in 2020. They were very happy with pandemic management, voted for John Horgan. Some of those seats are lost in 2024, right, particularly those in the Fraser Valley. But what was interesting to watch, and it's something that is similar to what is happening in the United States, is that the 18 to 34 crowd becoming more in tune with conservative politics, right, whether it's federal, whether it's provincial. The over 55 voter seems to be happy with the NDP, not giving David Eby the approval ratings that John Horgan had, but certainly not in a situation where they're looking at who is on the other side and are willing to make a bet and go, we're going to go conservative this time. Now, that could change once they have a full-time leader. But I think it was, when you look at the ferry situation, it's a calculated risk. If they had paid a lot more to build them here, then the conservatives would have gone, you paid a lot more when you could have gone to China. You go to China and they go, oh, why didn't you build them here? So you're going to get grief from the opposition regardless of your decision. It's still complicated because of everything that happened, especially related to the Donald Trump scenario and building more and doing more here. But, you know, it's interesting. We're at the end of the year. We're halfway through the podcast. In any other year, a BCGU strike would have been the first story we talked about. And now it's like, oh, and there was also that thing. So that really tells you how wacky the year was.
But the biggest story that really turned things upside down, which is still having ripple effects in this province where land use and real estate are always top of mind, happened in the summer. The BC Supreme Court decision on the long-running legal dispute, the land claim by the Cowichan tribes for a major part of Richmond, and it went the way of the Cowichan tribes. The government said pretty quickly, the NDP said pretty quickly, it was going to file an appeal. It's got a lot of the landowners in the area, whether they're farmers, whether they're real estate companies or warehouse owners, logistics companies. They don't know what their future is. Some of them are saying that they can't get loans. Some of them are saying they can't sell their land. David Eby and the NDP has now put $150 million of loans on the table to try to help them. But people are looking at that and saying $150 million for this amount of land, that's not going to cut it. There were calls to send this to the Supreme Court of Canada to make a quick decision. There were other decisions that happened more recently. North Coast tribe, the Kikatla band, on the mineral claim system, where you could go to a website, pay some money, and stake a claim for minerals. Well, that was happening while none of these tribes were getting consulted. And the law says you've got to consult and accommodate the local First Nation. And a judge said that in the Court of Appeal, two of the judges said, no, that doesn't fit with UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, one of the major legacies of the John Horgan era. And one of the judges said, well, this is a creation of the legislature.
Right.
This is the legislature's fault. The legislature should fix it.
Right.
And that is going to be a major concern going into 2026. How will the NDP fix this? How will the NDP also try to deal with this land claim lawsuit, which will have to go to the Court of Appeal and then the Supreme Court? It's going to be, maybe it'll be another 10 years before it's even decided. But there's a lot of people in British Columbia who now see that private land is now on the table in land claims when we were told for so many years it wasn't. And it has thrown a major monkey wrench into everything. And it's also caused animosity towards First Nations people, which is not what UNDRIP was supposed to do. It was supposed to bring and reconcile long-standing social economic issues with First Nations, make them equal, make them whole partners with the rest of British Columbians. But here we have a bit of a turning point in British Columbia on land use, different visions of it. And can David Eby and the NDP put it all together? Or is this going to be the fuel for whoever becomes the Conservative leader to take this to the voters and to unify voters one way or another?
Right. Well, I think it doesn't take away from the idea of reconciliation that most British Columbians actually support. You know, right after this happened, we were in field, we asked British Columbians, there's a high level of support for reconciliation. It's a concept that most people understand and have embraced. Similar situation for land acknowledgements. What you have is a lot of animosity on social media blaming reconciliation for everything that is happening. And it's definitely not something that we like to watch. The big thing here is the level of credibility when the Cowichan tribes say, we're not going to go after your house, is a complex issue. Because you have about 40% of people who say, yes, I think they can be believed. But we just don't know how this is going to evolve. And it's part of the complication for the government to try to do something when they can say, and this is something that many governments of all stripes have done, well, the case is before the courts. We don't have to talk about anything or say specifically what measures will be taken to deal with this. But it did enable a few people who are very upset with indigenous rights and who are very upset with reconciliation to essentially have a bully pulpit and say whatever they wanted to say about it. It's a delicate situation for the government, but it's something that is inherently out of their hands. The courts might actually say what needs to be said, and you know, part of the difficulty trying to analyze this is you talk to two lawyers about what the decision means, and you leave the table with 17 different opinions.
Andy, do you think that the NDP deserves a candy cane the way it's handled this issue, or a lump of coal?
I think on this one, it's a lump of coal. It's really the fact that, you know, politicians will show up for the photo ops, but not necessarily show up to do the work. And I think that this is really not only about UNDRIP, it's about UNDRIPA and how DRIPA didn't follow up on the work that was required to align existing laws and regulations to really what does really determine what does it mean, as opposed to just leave it to the courts. And I think that in that gap, the courts are only doing what they can do. And yet I think what's missing is really a really adequate description in terms of an explanation of the difference between Indigenous title versus private land rights and the kind of realities of what it actually is, as opposed to what people think it is. And I think that part of this is having in this vacuum of information of really what is the reality of this is the imagination. And we've seen certain parties sell that imagination of really what they think it means. And it's unfortunately taking fire on things like social media, but yet mm-hmm. there's an underlying complication in what the reality actually is and what the intentions of these respective nations are. And really, what does it actually mean towards the underlying responsibilities we have as British Columbians in this process of reconciliation? So I think a lot of this goes into the demand and need for real leadership in terms of really explaining to what this process of reconciliation, truth and reconciliation means, as opposed to letting certain imaginations run wild.
Now, we'll go to the federal scene right now. This time last year, could you have foreseen that...
Here we go.
Yeah.
That Mark Carney would be the prime minister, that Chrystia Freeland would be basically out of politics. Yeah. And that Justin Trudeau would be a groupie with Katy Perry. Would you have foreseen that? I mean, we were thinking this time last year that, 2025, we're on our way to a Prime Minister Polyev, the carbon tax will be taken away. Well, the carbon tax was taken away, reset to zero, it wasn't axed, and it was someone else different that did it. But of course, here we are at the end of the year, and Justin Trudeau is touring with Katy Perry around the world. His mother, of course, way back when in the 70s, was a groupie with the Rolling Stones. That'd be subject for a whole other podcast. But here we've got this situation where now Pierre Polyev is battling to stay as the leader of the Conservative Party, as the Liberals have been able to inch their way closer to majority territory by backroom deals, by getting floor crossers, lower profile members of parliament from the Conservative caucus. And so here we have it. Stranger things happen federally than they seem to do provincially or civically. Do you think that'll hold true for 2026? What do you think will happen federally? Where will we be this time next year? What will the party scene look like?
I think there's a couple of issues at play. The first one is whether Polyev is able to stay as leader. They haven't said what the magic number would be. Is it going to be 66%, 70%, 80%, 50 plus one? Same way that John Rostad said it, there's no magic number. There's no magic number. We'll see how the situation unfolds. They haven't really done a lot of effort to change the way he communicates with people. There's still this defiance and this idea that everything is wrong and I'm the one to fix it. That doesn't make him a more endearing character for people who didn't vote for the party. The other elephant in the room, a smaller orange elephant, is what happens with the NDP leadership race. Because a lot of the votes that went to the Liberals were borrowed. We saw long-standing urban NDP members of parliament losing their seats because people decided that Mark Carney was the better person to deal with Donald Trump. Right. Some of those voters might come back into the fold. Similar situation in Quebec, where we had people who had voted for the Bloc three elections in a row suddenly saying, let's save the country we belong to by voting Liberal, and then we can figure out if we can separate from Canada. So that is the essence of the argument. You know, a lot of these votes, and when you look at the history of this province, there's only been three times when the Liberals finish in first place federally. Trudeau-Mania 1, 1968, Trudeau-Mania 2, 2015, and now with Mark Carney in 2025. So this isn't something that happens all the time. It's not as if those Liberal voters are going to stay there forever. And that depends on how the Conservatives play out, whether Polyev stays and changes the way he behaves or where he goes, and who becomes the NDP leader.
And for you, Andy Yan, who do you think this time next year should get a candy cane versus a lump of coal? Who will be running the show? Could there be a snap election called by Mark Carney in order to get even bigger majority than looks like he's on his way to getting if they just get one more floor crosser, basically?
It's a really interesting question, because I was going to answer that perhaps it's a book that you give to these folks, and it's called Can Poly Fan Fiction. That this is really something that I think has this kind of backwards and forwards of some kind of novel you can't predict. And I think that a lot of this is really, I think, really touching upon, I think, this moment of uncertainty, this kind of unknown areas in terms of federal politics, in terms of our relationships to the United States, to the rest of the world. I think that, you know, some folks have said, hey, maybe we should get some kind of like affiliate membership with the EU. That I think that this is really, I think, the kind of larger question of really where can
Canada is in this world and the kind of uncertainties from the outside, but then also in the inside. That I think that a lot of this also it goes into really the interesting relationships between the provinces. That, you know, with the relationship that that the Carney government did with Alberta, and the kind of, like, I guess new somewhat stable relationships that they've had in terms of with the Albertan government, that really now what happens to British Columbia, and really I think that in terms of where the federal government is going, I think it really is trying to kind of deal with, I think, fires in numerous areas of global as well as national politics, through which I think is creating an incredible moment of uncertainty for Canadians. But yet at the same time, I think it looks like it's a question of who's not necessarily one of strength, but then just really how one has just a weak opposition at this moment. And I think, what does that mean towards, I think competent leadership into the future?
Yeah, and you mentioned there, you know, Canada possibly looking into joining the European Union. I think that the only major step forward on that file really was this year, the proposal in the budget that CBC get involved in finding a way to get Canada into the Eurovision Song Contest, which
small steps.
That's small steps. That's the worst part of being part of the European Union, in my book.
Oh yeah, Eurovision. It's known for some hits. I mean, it brought ABBA to the world, but yeah,
that's precisely why I am opposed to
it. It's known for many more misses, and misses. We'll end the podcast thinking about Miss Claus and Santa Claus coming to your neighborhood somewhere around Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, wherever you're watching this in the world. We want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
For Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Cabinet proposes fining those calling for a non-peaceful takeover of Taiwan. Draft changes to the National Security Act, including fines of up to $32,000 for advocating the end of Taiwan's sovereignty. The fines would be levied on those whose public speech, writing, artwork, or digital records call for Taiwan's forcible annexation by a foreign power. The proposal comes after authorities in March issued deportation notices for three Chinese nationals married to Taiwanese spouses for posting online videos that either advocated or alluded to a potential military takeover of Taiwan by China. In ABC News Australia, Bondi Beach gunmen spent November holed up in tiny hotel room in Philippines. Alleged terrorists Naveed and Sajid Akram spent almost a month holed up in a small hotel room in a city in the southern Philippines in the lead-up to the Hanukkah attack, local staff have said. Hotel staff showed the ABC through the room they say the father and son stayed in, which consisted of two single beds, a TV, and a basic bathroom. The hotel is in downtown Davao, the biggest city on the island of Mindanao, a region that has been challenged by Islamic extremism. In Kyoto News, monster wolf robot grabs spotlight as tool to scare off bears. Developed by Hokkaido-based precision machining company Oda Saiki Company, 330 of the robots are in use on farms, along animal trails, and elsewhere. The company is also developing other products, such as the Wolf Mover, a remote-controlled, self-propelled device to chase bears, and a portable-type monster wolf for use to fend off bears when hiking or camping. In other Japanese bear news, popular twin pandas Xiao Xiao and Lei Lei at Ueno Zoo will be returned to China in late January, a move that will leave Japan without any pandas for the first time in around half a century. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, as flu season hits, new K variant has health experts concerned and urging vaccinations. The H3N2 type of influenza virus, notorious over the years for leading to hospitalizations and deaths among older people, is showing up most so far this flu season. The Oregon Health Authority reports that 58.2% of positive tests analyzed at the Oregon State Public Health Laboratory have been H3, compared with 41.2% that have been H1N1. The good news is that H3N2 is one of three variants included in the 2025-2026 flu vaccine. The concerning news is that a mutation of that strain, one called subclade K, has become most prevalent this year. In Cascadia Daily News, Governor does sobering tour of Sumas, Everson, and Nooksack in damage review. Bob Ferguson is looking for ways the state could help improve infrastructure in flood-prone areas. Ferguson met Whatcom County leaders on December 17th, a week after historic flooding began to pummel the region as far north as Sumas to areas as far south as Seattle. The Nooksack River hit a record peak of 150.49 feet on Thursday, December 11th, flooding across the border into Abbotsford, B.C. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Court upholds Vancouver Island University suspension of anti-Israel activist. And Park Board War of Words ends in a tie. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.news podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to first responders, frontline hospital staff, and utility workers that keep the lights, heat, and plumbing on wherever you are. The folks who will not be home for Christmas. Merry Christmas, and thank you for your service. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.news podcast for the week of December 21st, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me, and Merry Christmas. Did you know that on the 21st of December in 1891, at Springfield College, Canadian James Naismith published the first rules of basketball, and his class in Springfield played the first game? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Bells were ringing out for Christmas.